On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On a main street in Amsterdam in late 2004, Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh was murdered by a Muslim assailant outraged by van Gogh's film depicting Islamic oppression of women. A death threat letter left stabbed to his chest was addressed to the woman who's my guest today, the Somali-born, Muslim-raised critic of Islam, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Hirsi Ali wrote the screenplay for the film Van Gogh died for. At 22, she had fled an arranged marriage for asylum in the Netherlands. She became a Dutch member of parliament and a scathing critic of Islam, its treatment of women, and the Western multiculturalism that she says tolerates too much. Joining me now from Washington is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, where she is now a resident fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. She's the author of The Caged Virgin and a new memoir, Infidel. She was born in Somalia and lived in Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, and Kenya as a child. She now lives under 24-hour police protection. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Thank you for having me.
A Muslim-raised woman out with a memoir, and the title is Infidel. Explain that for us, if you would.
Well, when I first started to discuss that certain aspects of Islam and aspects of liberal democracy were incompatible, I was called an infidel. And fellow Muslims kept on calling me an infidel. And I thought I might as well take it on. And I've become an infidel because I no longer believe that following the Prophet Muhammad as a moral guide today is something I want to do, and that makes me an infidel. I don't read the Quran as the word of God, but I see it as a book written by human beings, and that makes me an infidel. I no longer believe that I should distance myself from non-Muslims. I've got very warm and good friendships with them, and that makes me an infidel, and I can go on and on.
Is there a more explosive position to take for a Muslim-raised person, woman, than to reject exactly what you're rejecting there? Isn't that just about as incendiary in the Islamic culture as a person can be?
Unfortunately, that is the case. And if you compare Muslims to Christians, and you see Christians who say, well, I've become a Christian atheist, or look at Jews who say, I've become a Jewish atheist, they don't seem to find themselves in incendiary positions. And so when I used the term backward first, it was in relation to the other monotheistic religions to say, look, we need to catch up, because as long as we threaten and kill people who think otherwise, who have an imagination, who want to be different, then measured by that one standard, we can be called backward.
We're going to learn a lot about your history and your views in this hour. For much of the world, public awareness began, though not in the Netherlands, you're already well known there, but outside, with the murder of Theo van Gogh in 2004. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I wonder if you'd be good enough to read right from the beginning of your book your description of that awful day and the sort of context for it there. Would you be good enough to read something there for us?
Yes. One November morning in 2004, Theo van Gogh got up to go to work at his film production company in Amsterdam. He took out his old black bicycle and headed down a main road. Waiting in a doorway was a Moroccan man with a handgun and two butcher knives. As Theo cycled down the Linnea Strat, Mohamed Bouyeri approached. He pulled out his gun and shot Theo several times. Theo fell off his bike and lurched across the road and collapsed. Bouyeri followed. Theo begged, "Can't we talk about this?" But Bouyeri shot him four more times. Then he took out one of his butcher knives and sawed into Theo's throat. With the other knife, he stabbed a five-page letter onto Theo's chest. The letter was addressed to me. 2 months before, Theo and I had made a short film together. We called it Submission Part 1. I intended one day to make Part 2. Theo warned me that he would work on Part 2 only if I accepted some humor in it. Part 1 was about defiance, about Muslim women who shift from total submission to God to a dialogue with their deity. They pray, but instead of casting down their eyes, these women look up at Allah with the words of the Quran tattooed on their skin. They tell him honestly that if submission to him brings them so much misery and he remains silent, they may stop submitting. There is the woman who's flogged for committing adultery, another who's given in marriage to a man she loathes, another who's beaten by her husband on a regular basis, another who's shunned by her father when he learns that his brother raped her. Each abuse is justified by the perpetrators in the name of God, citing the Quran, now written on the bodies of the women. These women stand for hundreds of thousands of Muslim women around the world.
Somali-born, Muslim-raised author Ayan Hirsi Ali reading there from her new memoir, Infidel, and it is as controversial as you can get in the Islamic world. Ayan Hirsi Ali, you focus in the movie, in the reading just there, on the position of women in Islam. Is that the root of your critique of Islam today, or is it deeper than the treatment of women?
My critique is much deeper than women. It is on the individual human being. But I think that the most structural, systematic, best route to change is through women. And that if women are allowed to go to school, if they're allowed within Islamic countries and outside of Islamic countries, within Islamic communities, to earn their own money and become financially independent, and if most important of all, they're allowed to own their own bodies, then the reformation of Islam that everyone is longing for will come much sooner than we think. Let me give you an example. Mm. Last week, there was the news of a woman in Jordan, a young girl killed by her father because he suspected that she was not a virgin. Jordan is supposed to be one of the most liberal Arab Islamic countries today. And in the debate that followed, the king suggested that instead of punishing perpetrators of honor killings with just 6 months, he was going to raise it to the normal homicide punishment. Mm-hmm. But what I thought was fascinating about that article was the daughter who was killed was taken to doctors, and the doctors examined her virginity and declared that she was a virgin, and therefore the father was wrong.
But she was dead when they did this examination.
They did the examination when she was alive.
Oh, I see.
But what it shows is how institutionalized this obsession with virginity is.
And even though he knew that he was wrong, he killed her anyway because of a reputation issue?
Yes, and that when the king goes on to make changes, it's in the penal code, and it's not about saying, listen, let's forget the whole virginity thing, because that's the root cause is that a father thinks that if his daughter is not a virgin, he has a right to kill her.
Help us understand, if you would, the wider critique. In your opening reading, you talked about the issues, you know, the flogging and the issues that draw a lot of attention in the West. You say your critique is much broader. We've struggled in the West or outside Islam, particularly since 9/11, to understand this religion. You present it in very stark terms as in opposition to modernity or enlightenment values, and yet we're reminded again and again of a rather glorious intellectual tradition of Islam, if you go back far enough. What is your broader critique?
My broader critique is Islam was founded in an Arab desert tribal culture, and that it carries a lot of the Arab desert tribal elements and values in it. And the same, you would say, would go for other religions, but somehow, because, for example, Christianity and Judaism have gone through the Reformation, through the Enlightenment, they have seemed to shed that and have reconciled themselves with modernity. Islam has up to now been unable to do that because, yes, each and every time that an intellectual exercise takes place within Islam, that is subjugated. People who ask questions are exiled or killed or silenced in some way, and that is the root cause of the backwardness that the Islamic civilization has gotten itself into.
We can imagine Muslims objecting strongly to backwardness, describing their own religion. Many people would when describing their religion, but also I can imagine listeners thinking, the way you describe it, it almost seems to make conflict inevitable or even necessary. Is your view of Islam a kind of prescription for holy war?
No, I think conflict is necessary and it's urgent because some people want to keep the status quo. Others, like the followers of Bin Laden, actually want to take us back to the 7th century. And some of us who are born into Islam, like myself, Irshad Manji, and others, want to move on. That means then conflict is inevitable. But what is more important is how you solve that conflict. I want to talk about it, to discuss, to get a following through persuasion, telling people, let's change. But unfortunately, what the people we have now come to call the fundamentalists or radicals think that people like me should be killed. And that's what, it's not the first time that this is happening in history. This has been happening in the history of Islam for centuries now.
Ayan Hirsi Ali, I wish you'd take us back to a bit of your origin so we can understand where you're coming from. You're Somali-born. Your father was a dissident in the time of Siad Barre, ruling Somalia. You moved around a lot. Tell us where and how your childhood helped shape your relationship with Islam.
Well, like any other child born into Islam, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, I was sent to the Quran school, the madrasa, to learn the Quran by heart. And as time went by, I was taught to pray. When I became a teenager, I started to cover, later going much further than was required of me.
Mm-hmm.
I even went to madrasas, joined the Islamic Brotherhood, or at least sympathized with it. And was a devout Muslim. I grew up in a household where my mother did the cooking, the cleaning. She took care of. She did what a woman should do as a Muslim woman. And by the way, I know that that also goes for other cultures. And my father worked outside the house, was completely involved in his politics. We lived in Saudi Arabia at one point, and I've seen Islam put into practice in its most pure form, and in which there's a complete separation of the sexes as much as possible, where even in the home there is a section for women, and the mother and the daughters and all the other women who are around, and the other section of the house is just for the men. So that that has shaped my understanding and my practice of Islam. I'm what you would call a regular Muslim coming from a third world country.
Though Somalia is not just any third world country, I mean, one of the things that's gotten a lot of attention there is female circumcision or female genital mutilation, depending how people call it. Yes. It's pretty much standard practice in Somalia. It was standard practice for you when you were very young. Does that... now that you live in the West and have adopted a kind of different perspective on the world, is that a source of fury in your life? Or are you a source of resentment for you toward the religious culture you grew up in, your own genital mutilation?
Oh, no. As I explain in the book, female genital mutilation predated Islam. And it's practiced in among societies that are not Muslim. So that's not something you can blame Islam on. And I'm not infuriated about it happening to me. I understand and explain the context in which it happened, in which my grandmother thought she was doing me a big favor. And she still believes that. So she was very genuine about it. But it was important to point out in relation to Islam, because Muslims are completely obsessed with ensuring that a girl is a virgin. So an old practice like this one, in which... the opening of the female genitalia are closed, that is today practiced in more Islamic societies than non-Islamic societies, because it meets that need, the function. It has that function of ensuring that a girl is a virgin. And that can be eradicated once this obsession with virginity is addressed and dropped.
We've heard about this for a long time, but I've never read it written about with quite the same... openness and intimacy that you do in your memoir by someone who's been there. You were, I think, 5 years old at the time. It's strong stuff, but it takes us into that culture in a way that I've never quite seen before. I wonder if you'd be good enough to read for us, Ayan Hirsi Ali, from that time in your life. You were off at the madrasa, as you say. You'd been in some fist fights there, been sort of called out and had some trouble there. But then your parents were away. Your grandmother, the sort of guardian of traditional Somali culture, was home. You and your brother and sister, your brother not yet circumcised either at his age, and then came the day when tradition was brought to each of you. Would you be good enough to read that for us?
Yes. Not long after that first fight of mine at the madrasa, Grandma decided that the time was right for us to undergo the necessary and proper dignity of purification. My father was in jail and my mother was away for long periods, but Grandma would ensure that the old traditions would be respected in the old ways. After she made the arrangements, Grandma was cheerful and friendly all week long. A special table was prepared in her bedroom, and various aunts, known and unknown, gathered in the house. When the day itself came, I was not frightened, just curious. I had no idea what was going to happen, except that there was a festive atmosphere in the house, and we, all three of us, were going to be cleansed. I wouldn't be called Kinterlei anymore. Mahad went fast. I was driven out of the room, but after a while I stole back to the door and watched. Mahat was on the floor with his head and arms on Grandma's lap. Two women were holding down his spread-eagled legs, and a strange man was bending down between them. The room was warm, and I could smell a mixture of sweat and frankincense. Grandma was whispering in Mahat's ears, "Don't cry, don't stain your mother's honor. These women will talk about what they have seen. Grit your teeth." Mahat wasn't making a sound, but tears rolled down his face as he bit into Grandma's shawl. His face was clenched and twisted in pain. I couldn't see what the stranger was doing, but I could see blood. This frightened me. I was next. Grandma swung her hand from side to side and said, "Once this long kinter is removed, you and your sister will be pure." From Grandma's words and gestures, I gathered that this hideous kinter, my clitoris, would one day grow so long that it would swing sideways between my legs. She caught hold of me and gripped my upper body in the same position as she had put Mahat. Two other women held my legs apart. The man, who was probably an itinerant traditional circumciser from the blacksmith clan, picked up a pair of scissors. With the other hand, he caught hold of the place between my legs and started tweaking it, like Grandma milking a goat. "There it is, there is the kinter," one of the women said. Then the scissors went down between my legs, and the man cut off my inner labia and clitoris. I heard it, like a butcher snipping the fat off a piece of meat. A piercing pain shot up between my legs, indescribable, and I howled. Then came the sewing. The long, blunt needle clumsily pushed into my bleeding outer labia. My loud and anguished protests. Grandma's words of comfort and encouragement. "It's just this once in your life, Ayan. Be brave, he's almost finished." When the sewing was finished, the man cut the thread off with his teeth. That's all I can recall of it.
Ayan Hirsi Ali reading from her new memoir, Infidel. This was a tradition that your parents were opposed to, but your grandmother, in their absence, saw to it that it happened anyway. Why was she so concerned to have this happen?
For several reasons, the most important of which is, if you reach the age of marriage and the clitoris has not been removed, you've not been cleansed, then you will find no husband. Next reason, as an uncleansed girl, this reflects on the rest of the family and the clan, and you will be, the whole family will be shunned and will fall victim to shameful behavior. As my grandmother is superstitious, she also really believes that probably the clitoris would grow into something big that might dangle between your legs. It's seen to, the cutting of the clitoris is seen to reduce the sexual urge, which, as a girl becomes a teenager, might help her to control her sexual urges, and so on. So there are so many reasons that this is done. And you have to realize that this happens every 10 minutes a girl is circumcised in the world. According to the figures of the United Nations, 140 million women have undergone this procedure.
I should
say, so it's not something that's uncommon here.
I should say for our listeners, you can read passages from Ayan Hirsi Ali's memoir, Infidel, at our website, onpointradio.org. you've left the Netherlands. You're in the United States now, affiliated with a conservative think tank in Washington, the American Enterprise Institute. What's brought you out of Europe and to the U.S.?
I had decided to leave politics. When I became a member of parliament in Holland, I went into politics to address the issue of the position of Muslim women in the Netherlands and to say that if we want the assimilation process to be successful, we have to address cultural values and religious values, because that's what can either cause individuals to be successful or not to be successful. And after having done that for 2 years, I discovered that I had succeeded in creating the necessary awareness. And I thought I must finish my term for 4 years. And that's when I started to apply to the American Enterprise Institute, among other think tanks, to come and live and work here in the United States.
Was there some particular reason to be in the U.S.? Was your safety, were you unprotectable in the Netherlands at this point? Was there some message you're trying to bring to Americans in particular?
It was nothing lofty. It was the chance of being anonymous in the United States was important for me, and I was become, you know, I had become, I couldn't go to the supermarket in the Netherlands without getting a lot of recognition and a lot of causing a lot of flurry. Then there's of course the security issue. But also I thought that the debate, which is a global debate, I found it to be more challenging if I participated in it here in the United States than if I continued to remain in Dutch politics.
Mm. Ayaan Hirsi Ali writes in her memoir, Infidel, Theo van Gogh's murderer and others like him don't realize how deeply people in the West are committed to the idea of an open society. Even though the open society is vulnerable, it is also stubborn, she writes. It is the place I ran to for safety and freedom. I would like to keep it that way, safe and free. We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Ayaan Hirsi Ali. I want to turn to our callers, if I may. Shavnon is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Shavnon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. All right. You know, I just don't know where to begin. I just cannot stand this lady. First of all, the movie she made with Theo van Gogh.
Submission. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that has to do with Islam. Number one, it has a forced marriage in the movie. And in Islam, it is very, very clearly in Islamic law, in the hadiths of the Prophet, that no woman, virgin or matron, should be married without her consent.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just well known and it's ingrained. So I don't know if she comes from a backward family or whether Somalia is backward or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
I come from Pakistan and nobody ever, we are asked three times at the
mm-hmm.
ceremony whether we give her consent.
So point one, consent. You see it as part and parcel of Islam. What about her broader critique? What about the broader critique, Shavna?
The second point in the movie, this woman is raped by her uncle.
Mm.
Okay, as if rapes don't happen anywhere else in the world except for Islamic countries. And thirdly, in Islamic law, it has always been the case that the rapist is to be executed.
Mm.
Full stop.
Mm.
But in this country, what happens when a woman is raped? The rapist is probably put in prison for a year
mm-hmm.
and then he's let out. So I don't know what she's talking about. So and then another point that I'd like to say is the female circumcision.
Yes.
That is an East African custom,
mm.
which Muslims, Christians, and neither religion in East Africa practice it. They've always practiced it, and they still practice it. That has nothing to do with Islam. It is not practiced in East Asia, in South Asia, in Iran
mm.
or Libya. I've lived in other Islamic countries.
Shavnon, if you'll permit me, let me ask you about the broader critique. We have those three points, loud and clear. What about the broader critique? Ayaan Hirsi Ali says Islam is in kind of in conflict necessarily with Enlightenment values, with reason,
okay,
with modernity.
Okay, you know what? First of all, I'd like to say one thing,
mm-hmm.
that she should read more before she makes her statements. And secondly, she obviously doesn't know anything about what you alluded to yourself, about the 1,000 years when Islam was actually closer to its roots,
mm.
was closer to its roots when throughout Europe. And throughout Europe, Jews were being persecuted, not just Jews, other heretics were being persecuted, burned at the stake, mass killings in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal were under Islam, and they were flourishing, and there's a golden age of, in fact, Spain never had a golden age.
Shevnan, hold the thought. You've got a lot at your fingertips. Please hang in there. Ayan Hirsi Ali, what do you say in response? You hear Shevnan, she says, this is your culture, this is not Islam generally, and don't forget this glorious history and tradition, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Well, I want to confirm the glorious history and tradition. At one point, yes, the Western world was behind the Islamic world, let's say the Judeo-Christian world. But what I find so fascinating about the history of the West is through questioning, through self-reflection, through the examination of ideas, this world has progressed. And what the caller today here is saying is, look, once upon a time, we too were able to ask questions. My question back to her and all other Muslims is then, what happened? Why did we stop? Why? Where did the stagnation come from?
Ayan, hold the thought for a moment, if you would. Shevnan, if you're there, is that the right question? And do you have an answer to it?
Sure, yes, I do have an answer to it. For example, I'm from Pakistan, and for 200 years, the British colonized us, and they destroyed the education system that there was. They destroyed it because they wanted to destroy Islam. Because even though Islam was not the majority religion in the Indian subcontinent, the rulers, the ruling class was Muslim, and so the education was.
Do you think Islam is capable of reform within now?
No, it's not a question of reforming. It's a question of going back.
Barry is calling from Leominster, Massachusetts. Barry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Ian.
Hi.
Hello.
I wanted to find out a couple things. Actually, first, great topic, great focus. I'm sorry, Ian, I haven't been in touch sooner. I've read about you. I meant to do it over in the Netherlands, and very fascinated. Hope to get that opportunity. Have a question for you, but first a quick comment. Congratulations to the Dutch people for not reacting in a continuation and reverberating and escalating visceral way to that horrible murder. Imagine if that took place in so many other places in the world. Congratulations.
Though there has been some reaction there, and we'll speak to that, but what's your word to Ayan, Barry?
Yeah, my question to you, Ayan, is how do you contain within yourself the visceral reverberations as a result of the extreme situations that you have endured? How critical it is for the next phase and into the future, each of us to do it personally when we've experienced horrible things as you have.
Barry, let us pick it up. Ayan, this has been raised. I mean, we've heard some about your childhood, a death threat to you, stabbed into the chest of a friend and colleague, and it's been raised. You know, has Ayan Hirsi Ali swung too radically against her own religion and culture in a sort of blind way because of these brutal events?
My answer is no, and I try to explain that in the book. I wasn't aware of any of that, and I had never brought any life experience of mine in connection with Islam before the 11th of September 2001. Mm. And it's after that event that two things happened. Western leaders started to appeal to every Muslim to say, please say this is not done in my religion. Mm. And the perpetrators, with Bin Laden and his following, said, you have to make a choice. This is Islam, and we are going to fight for a caliphate. And I was just as horrified as many people were by what happened on the 11th of September. And I thought, this is not done in my religion. I cannot imagine God wanting this. And then I started to read Muhammad Atta's letter, which was painfully familiar, and download the passages from the internet written by Bin Laden that were inciting Muslims to go and fight. And I compared his quotations from the Quran to the Quran, and I was deeply disturbed and shocked and pained to find all that Bin Laden was saying in there. And that brought me to make my own personal choice. Do I want this or don't I want it? And when I got into this predicament between my conscience and the Quranic commandments, I chose my conscience, and that immediately made me into an infidel. And so it's not that I'm swinging, I'm being too radical. I don't see what is radical in saying, let's reform our religion, let's change the way we look at the world and our moral framework.
But your critique of Islam seems, at points, to put it almost beyond reform. After 9/11, lots of Western leaders, there was shock, but there was also a very open effort to say, let's look for the good in this religion. We must find it. We've seen bad things done in the name of many religions. Let's look and find the good here. You write that multiculturalism, sometimes the effort to kind of be accommodating, reach out, is a mistake. I'm quoting you here. You say, we in the West, where you're putting yourself now, would be wrong to prolong the pain of a transition to the modern world, I guess of Islam, unnecessarily by elevating cultures full of bigotry and hatred toward women to the stature of respectable alternative ways of life. But there are a billion Muslims in the world. Are we to see all of them as following an unrespectable way of life?
No, I try to repeat this again and again and again. Mm. Let's make a distinction between Islam and Muslims. Muslims, as individual human beings, are endowed with reason and are able to think and change their minds. We are also equal. So in that sense, I'm a universalist. When it comes to Islam as a body of ideas, I see no evidence to say that that philosophy, if you'd like, that recipe for life and the culture that has come out of it, is equal to the culture of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And for all the people who attack me on saying that I'm too radical, no one has given me, I've been reproached again and again, but no one has provided me with any evidence to say that the two cultures, the Islamic culture and the Western culture, are equal.
Equal, you say?
Yes, equals.
But there are many stripes of culture. We've been taught to think about things not necessarily as equal or unequal, but as different. You say no. Don't embrace this multiculturalism because this is actually a threat to core Western values.
Yes.
But I come again to the fear that isn't that a recipe for religious war between these two? I mean, if you say Muslims themselves, they have the capacity for logic and so on. Well, of course. But I hear it sounds as though you're saying that as Muslims, they're irredeemable, that Islam itself is irredeemable. No?
No, okay. Muslims are not irredeemable, certainly not. It would be pointless to be doing what I'm doing if I thought Muslims were irredeemable.
Can they hang on to their Islamic faith and be redeemable is too strong a word, but maybe not the way you put it. Can they be good Muslims and modern colleagues?
Let me put the question differently. Every time that a Muslim is confronted with a conflict between his conscience regarding the life and the liberty of others and a Quranic command, if the Muslim is able to follow his conscience and save lives or not threaten lives, then I think that that person can say, I will stick or keep of my Islam, of my faith, those parts that are compatible with liberal democracy. And what multiculturalism holds is, even when all cultures are equal within a liberal society, and that when things such as polygamy, for example, or female genital mutilation, or any custom or habit or religious belief that threatens the freedoms of others, that should be accommodated. And that's what I'm against. I'm saying if, as individuals, we are all equal before the law, then that has to be in practice as well, even with among minority communities, even among minority religions.
Mary's calling from Camden, South Carolina. Mary, you're on the air with Ayan Hirsi Ali.
Yes, hi. I just want to tell Miss Ali that I think she is one of the bravest women on this earth right now, to think that she's putting her life on the line. And I've read the Quran, and I know that I don't see the grace in the Quran. I don't see the hope. I know that there are a lot of intellectual Muslims that are looking for that, and I just think that this lady is just incredible. And
but Mary, can a billion
that is just incredible?
Let me ask you: do you think a billion fellow humans can be so wrong? A whole faith of a billion people without grace, without hope, does that really fit with your experience of humans?
Listen, all I know is that in this world, there's not a Muslim country I would want to live in. As a woman,
but how many have you visited? Are you sure?
I've been to the Middle East, and I've been to Turkey, which is considered a liberal place, And I did not see the freedom. I did not see it's there is an oppression. I can't describe it. It's an oppression. And that lady from Pakistan that called earlier,
yes,
just, you know, why isn't she in Pakistan? Would you want to live in Pakistan?
Well, people live in all kinds of countries. Well, now, I must say, you know, there? I've lived in, I've traveled in countries of all kinds and found some Islamic countries very hospitable.
I'm in America. I'm just so, I just hope that lady is just so, I just hope she sees that there's something in the Protestant religion that grace is what she's looking for. And I found it in Christ Jesus. And I just hope that for her. And I just think, anyway.
Mary, we hear where you're coming from, and we appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may, from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Imran is on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I would say that I have two points to make. One is that I think that, you know, the author is really kind of conflating two issues, which is religion and culture. And I think that if you look at Islam as it's practiced in America, for example, or the way it's even practiced in Pakistan, it's vastly different from the way it's practiced in Somalia. And all of the examples that she cited as, I guess, causes for her consternation, you know, the genital mutilation and et cetera, I mean, these don't happen here in the United States and certainly don't happen in Pakistan.
But she does point to Saudi Arabia as well, where she lived as a young woman and says, well, that was pretty tough stuff.
Right. So this gets back to my point about mixing culture and religion. And there are cultures, I think, around the world that have practices that are very different from our own. And those cultural practices actually mix into the religion. If you look at Pakistan, for example, there is a lot of Hindu culture that mixes in with Islam. You look at wedding ceremonies as an example, and you see Hindu culture mixed in with Muslim culture as well as the religion. And the same, I'll say, you look at, she likes to draw the distinction between the West and Islam. And I said, you know, look at it, how Islam is practiced in America, and I'll show you the fact that it looks very similar to Western ideals. And the other point I wanted to make was this constant kind of hail back to, you know, Enlightenment values. I mean, under Enlightenment in Europe, you know, there was 200 to 300 years of subjugation of other countries, basically of brown skin and black skin people.
Imperialism and, right alongside it, yes.
Right, with religion mixed in and trying to bring Christianity to the heathen. So I wouldn't, you know, hold Enlightenment up as the end-all, be-all of, you know, humanity. I think it comes down to just the way individual cultures that are located in different geographies with different influences, you know, impact on religion.
Imran, you give us a lot to look at. Let us pick it up. Ayan?
Imran, thank you very much. First of all, let me say that there is no Sharia or Sharia law in the United States. But in every country that has Sharia law in its family law, which are many, and some countries are completely ruled by the Sharia, which is the Islamic law, like Iran and Afghanistan under the Taliban and Saudi Arabia. But even countries like Morocco had Sharia as their, and Pakistan. Look at the divorce laws. A woman cannot divorce herself from her husband. It's next to impossible. She has to prove that he can't feed her, that he's impotent, that he can't give her children. A man, all he has to say is in the presence of two witnesses, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and the divorce is done. The testimony of a woman is worth half that of a man. You need two women to testify before that testimony is credible, and just one man equal to that. Then you have the inheritance laws, in which a girl inherits only a quarter, sometimes half of what her brother inherits. Then there is the veil. And all these laws, the family law regarding women, are into Sharia law. This is not a matter of culture. And this is logical because Islam was founded in an Arab desert tribal culture, and a lot of the aspects of that tribal culture have been elevated into religion.
But Imran says, look at the way Islam is practiced today in the United States, and he says you can see an example of how it can be practiced in a different cultural environment differently.
Let me point out that the United States Constitution and the United States law does not allow women to be denied their rights. So, of course, things will be different here because you can appeal to the law. And Canada last year, there was the whole debate in which the Islamic community tried to convince the province of Ontario to introduce bits and pieces of Sharia law, Islamic law, family law into the arbitration system. And Canada is a country that's very much in love with multiculturalism, and it almost succeeded, but fortunately it was turned down. So let's please not confuse things here. And then on the Enlightenment, I have never denied that horrible things and horrifying things have occurred in the West. The history of slavery and the history of the civil rights being taken away from the blacks here, but also of imperialism and so on and so forth. But there were Enlightenment thinkers here in the West who pointed out again and again the injustice in that. And it's within this Western culture that they've been able to succeed and to change and improve the lives of those who are oppressed. And all I'm saying is, let's as Muslims do the same. Let's start asking questions, create movements to improve the rights of women, the rights of gays, the rights of unbelievers in Islamic countries, and do that even when the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad tell us that it's wrong to do. So I don't see, I don't really think that Imran and I have different thoughts on this.
Our time grows short. I want to understand a little more fully what you're suggesting then. Are you saying West confront Islam, or how can these work together? What about the tradition of reform within Islam? I think ijtihad, it's called. Can Islamic reformers come to the fore? What are you suggesting for the West's interaction with Islam in this very volatile time we live in?
For the West, I'm saying, do not underestimate the conviction of those Muslims who say destruction to the West, who provide an alternative system of life to the Western philosophy of life and liberty. And to Muslims, my message is clear again and again. The Prophet Muhammad as a moral guide today cannot be followed in all. The Quran is not written by God, but it's written by human beings. We can reflect on it. And even if we cannot change what's written in the Quran, we can change how we look at it and how we live by it. And for all that to happen, we need a basis in which those Muslims who think differently or who want to engage in dialogue with one another and reflect are not threatened and killed.
We only have 30 seconds, but are you saying leave Islam or change Islam?
That's up to the Muslims themselves. I keep on making that distinction between Islam and Muslims. It's up to the Muslims to decide what happens to Islam. But I'm appealing to the Muslims, do not kill those who think differently and who think.
A lot on the table. Ayaan Hirsi Ali's new memoir is Infidel. And wow, what a message. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, thank you for your time today. Good luck to you. We appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Listeners, to read passages and see photos from Ayaan Hirsi Ali's new memoir, Infidel, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, by Lena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Philip Martin, Thomas Martzall, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, and Christina Russo. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.